This is episode number 759 of the Secret Identity Podcast, and today in What's New, we're going to talk about some upcoming shows, as well as Red Stylo's Query Call for their new anthology. Our books this week are going to be Gotham Academy number 4, Supergirl Being Super number 1, Inhumans versus X-Men number 0, and Daredevil number 14.
Before we get started, does anyone want to get out?
The Human Torch was denied a bank loan.
This is all your fault, you.
Get that finger out of your ear. You don't know where that finger's been.
Why do you keep staring at me?
You have 20 seconds to comply.
And welcome, everybody, to Secret Identity. This is Brian Letendry here, as always, with the lovely, the talented, the beautiful, the guy wearing a shirt that I envy, Matthew A. Herring. How are you today, sir?
Doing well. British Steel.
Now, where did you get that shirt, and how old is that shirt?
So, just got it for Christmas.
I love it.
And the reason being, I was telling my daughter, my oldest Becky, that when I was a kid and I started to get into heavy metal, it was...
As every kid should.
It was interesting because I first heard Living After Midnight. No, I'm sorry, Breaking the Law. I saw the video for Breaking the Law on like Friday night videos
or
something. Sure,
absolutely.
The next day, I went to the record store to buy that album to start my trek and
to start the
march
path to metalhood. Yes.
And then when I was walking around, I saw the British Steel t-shirt. This was at the old Record Town at the Enfield Mall. Had the British Steel t-shirt, and I said, you know what? I really would rather have the album, but I want people to know that I'm a fan of this band.
Yes.
And it was interesting because I was telling Becky, I said, to me it was more important that people knew I belonged to something than I actually could have it to listen to at home.
Right.
So I bought the shirt. A week later, I bought the album, but she went and bought the shirt for me at Christmas.
That's awesome. I love
this shirt. This is probably one of the, I would say, 10, 15 greatest albums – metal albums of all time and at least covers of all time.
I know people love when we start talking about music right off the top of the show. I am having a real tough time deciding because on Thrash It Out, we only do one album from a band. And I am definitely going to be doing a Judas Priest album in the third volume of Thrash It Out, but I'm having a really tough time narrowing it down. Obviously, Painkiller is up there.
Probably the most thrashiest heavy of them all.
Yes, which I think will click with a lot of people, maybe who aren't even Judas Priest fans. My current favorite that I can't get away from is Sad Wings of Destiny.
That is such a great album.
Because it's not even 40 minutes long.
Nope.
But I cannot stop listening to that album. So every time I start flipping through my Judas Priest stuff digitally, I end up on Sad Wings of Destiny. Defenders of the Faith is great. I mean, they're all great in their own way. Even like Angel of Retribution. What was the new one that came out?
I think that was
Redeemer
that?
Of Souls.
Redeemer of Souls.
Redeemer of Souls.
Very
great.
Good.
Like, it's so hard to pick one. Like, that's a band that's almost as hard for me as like picking a Megadeth album or something like that. So, Judas Priest, fantastic. To put it, exclamation point on our musical note for the week, I went and saw the Squirrel Nut Zippers at the Outer Space Ballroom in Connecticut. Where was it? It was in Hamden, Connecticut, which is right next to New Haven. And it was a tiny little place, like tinier than the Stafford Palace Theater that we went to see Saxon in. And the group that opened for them was called Davina and the Vagabonds, which I'm telling you this because if you at all like that Louisiana jazz meets swing type sound, Davina and the Vagabonds, outstanding. And then Squirrel Nut Zippers came on. And it's really Jimbo Mathis with a bunch of new people from over the years. But they were celebrating the 20th anniversary of Hot, which was their most famous album. Everybody has heard the song Hell that came out way back in the day when they were big on MTV and in rotation and stuff like that. But what a show. Amazing energy. Just unbelievable musicianship. Like some of the best horn players I've ever seen were on the stage that night. The trumpet player for Davina and the Vagabonds is ridiculous. He was like the Yngwie Malmsteen of trumpet players. Like he was just destroying it up there. So all I have to say about that is whether you like heavy metal, whether you like swing music, whether you like whatever, go and see live music.
Yes.
There is nothing like seeing live music. And one of my sort of vows over the past few years was that I was going to start going to a lot more shows, and that will continue in 2017.
We got a lot.
Just because there's nothing like that. And yep. For some of these bands, like it may be the like perfect example, Squirrel Nut Zippers, I saw 18 years ago.
Yep.
At the University of Hartford. And I just assumed that I would have plenty of opportunities to see them over the years, or I'd get to see them again or whatever. Here we are, 2017. And I was lucky enough to see them again 18 years later. So that's crazy. Like, go see those bands. Go enjoy them while they're still around, or if they get back together or whatever, and you never get a chance to see them, like, go see live music. It's so much fun.
Yep. Everything is out there, and that's the cool thing about it. And you've got all – you don't have to be a metal fan. And granted, you and I tend to spend a lot more time in the metal world, but there is some amazing stuff out there. Even just go to any clubs just to check out some local bands. It's always fun. There's something about just sitting there or standing there and enjoying live music and discovering maybe a new band for the first time. There's nothing yep. better than that.
And we don't even drink. I mean, we just go yes. for the music. It's just a wonderful time. So, all right, Matthew, you've been driving all night. Your eyes are heavy, and you think about pulling off this endless stretch of highway to catch a few hours sleep. But what's that glow on the horizon? You rub your eyes, but it's still there. Millions of lights and miles of neon bully the stars, selling every flavor of vice. The siren song of slots spills out onto the strip where castles, pyramids, coliseums, and the Eiffel Tower stand sentinel. Fountains dancing and waving to each other in turn. Elvis is alive, well, and standing on every corner. He serenades young lovers cruising through drive-through chapels, hours away from divorces of equal convenience, once the booze and glitter have worn off. Is that a UFO on the horizon? Don't wander off to investigate. You might find yourself digging a hole for a couple of made men, and they ain't putting planting flowers, capiche? What is this place, this gaudy oasis in the heart of the desert? A dream? A mirage? Nah. This is Vegas, baby. That is the opening salvo from Red Stylo Media, who is currently holding an open query for a new anthology that they're doing. Now, you've heard me talk about the 27 Club. I interviewed Enrique Jang on mm-hmm. the show multiple times, but the last time to talk about the 27 Club, which was a critically acclaimed
Very
anthology,
good book.
And we both grabbed it as well, and it was just absolutely lovingly put together. So they say, last year we hit the jackpot with the Harvey Award-nominated 27 Club. As a follow-up, we're letting it ride with Strip, a twisted Vegas comic anthology. Weird and Warped Tales from Las Vegas is the theme, and the format remains the same as our past anthologies. We're looking for 8-page comics, posters, and vignettes in tribute to and inspired by the original City of Sin itself. Pieces can be inspired by the music, the mob, the lights, the luck, whatever vision Vegas conjures for you. Now, the way that this works is that if you are an artist or you are a writer that are interested in pitching for this, the first thing you have to do is you have to go to the Red Stylo website, which I'll put a link to in the show notes, and you have to submit a query form to basically say, I'm interested in pitching for this anthology. And then what they do is they pick from, and you tell them a little bit about yourself, and then they will pick from the people that have asked to pitch, and you, if selected, will be asked to pitch. So you're not submitting a pitch, you're submitting a query saying, I'm interested in pitching. And then if they pick you and they reach out and contact you, you can then pitch your story. And then from there, they choose the ones that they want to put in the anthology. It says, everyone can expect a reply within 2 weeks of receipt. If you haven't heard from us, please check our guidelines and send again. The open call lasts until February 15th. So you have until February 15th. You go to the Red Stylo Media website, which I believe is redstylo.com, and you send them that query form before the 15th of February. So if you've ever had a hankering to write a tale that involves Las Vegas, then this is the time to jump in.
I have an idea.
And they're great people to work with.
Yeah, I think I have an idea. As you're reading that, I'm like, which way would I go with that? What would I cover? What would I look at talking about Vegas? And I probably would go with that desperation of losing it all kind of thing. That's where I went. I've got an idea. I'm going to have to maybe formulate it.
I know we have creators that listen to the show. So please, if you are interested, then please reach out. I mean, they do fantastic work over there. And Red Stylo is known for their awesome anthologies. And so now, especially building off the success of the 27 Club, I'm very, very excited to see what they come up with. And hopefully I will talk to Enrique at some point in the near future so we can hear more about that from her.
And you can also imagine how much fun that would be to be included in an anthology that was a Harvey nominated and maybe Harvey award-winning anthology.
There you go. What else do we have this week? Matthew, Boom Studios made my dreams come true this week.
Hmm.
And I had some dreams smashed this week, so it was good to have some dreams be brought to fruition this week. What is my favorite movie of all time, Matthew?
Big Trouble in Little China.
Big Trouble in Little China is my favorite movie of all time. We've already talked about how Boom has done an amazing job with the Big Trouble in Little China comic that they've been putting out over there. And really, their partnership in general with John Carpenter, because they also do the Escape from New York comics, and they recently did a crossover series as well. All great, fun stuff. And clearly, those guys love the property as much as hardcore fans do, like myself. What was really cool, though, and I did not know until I saw it actually come out this week, is that they had partnered with John Carpenter to put out a book, a Making of Big Trouble in Little China book.
Wow.
With exclusive behind-the-scenes interviews and information and pictures and set photos and all that kind of awesome stuff. And I know there's a few of our fans right now who are freaking out as they're hearing this. And so I know they're excited as I am. All of this behind-the-scenes stuff, like little vignettes on each character, all this kind of stuff about how the story came together. There's a foreword in it by John Carpenter himself. It looks amazing. And I have seen the digital version of this. I am getting the print version of this, and I could not be more excited about it. So if you love Big Trouble in Little China like I do, that is currently out. It came out this Wednesday, and it's amazing. And I think you can actually order it on Amazon now, although I think on Amazon it comes out as you listen to this, it will be out, but it comes out the following Wednesday on Amazon. But you can get it on Amazon. You can get it through Boom. You can order it probably through your local comic store because it is put out through Boom. And I cannot recommend it highly enough because, A, it's the greatest movie of all time. B, this is a super awesome project from people who love Carpenter stuff as much as we do. And I want to support that.
And considering I just saw the movie about 2 or 3 months ago for the first time.
You know, and we never did our Saturday matinee about that, but I think, what did you think about it overall?
I liked
talking
it.
It
definitely is something that if I saw it as a youngin,
sure,
I would have appreciated it a lot more because I had to watch it now. You're watching it now in the spirit of what it was in the time period, what they were doing. Because again, like every great movie, you could throw The Empire Strikes Back in there. You could throw every Star Wars movie. There are holes in the plot all over the place because these movies are not made.
Are they holes, Matthew? Because I would argue that they are not holes.
Do you know what they are? They're little cubbies for us to hide in and enjoy.
You know what they are? Is they're little places for you to pause and reflect on what it is that's happening in the larger story.
Yes.
That's all.
And I, for what it was, I really enjoyed it. I picked it up on Blu-ray. I love the look. I love the feel. The music is typical. It's John Carpenter. It's that
amazing
synth music that you would expect in every single
with a little
thing.
Bit of rock and roll yep. thrown in, which is perfect for Jack Burton as a character.
Yep.
That whole movie is everything. I remember reading about that movie. I want to say it was in Black Belt magazine. Now, keep in mind, I never actually took martial arts when I was a kid, but since the very first time that I saw Shokushugi in Enter the Ninja.
Yep.
And then Revenge of the Ninja, which was amazing, and just started to follow him and get into martial arts movies. And Chuck Norris was a huge, huge hero to me when I was a kid.
And Quick Kick.
Well, obviously Quick Kick. So I was fascinated by the martial arts without having any martial arts training when I was a kid. I, you know, made my own ninja outfits. I was a ninja for Halloween. We had a whole area of woods behind our house that I used to go and pretend to be a ninja in. And of course, anytime we played G.I. Joe, I was Quick Kick mm-hmm. and all that kind of stuff. And I remember reading, it was either in Kung Fu Magazine or Black Belt Magazine, and I think it was Black Belt, and I'm so mad that I don't have it anymore. They did a whole segment in that magazine about the movie before it came out.
Wow.
Like, oh, is this going to resonate with people? You know, is it an homage to the culture? Is it, could it be seen as offensive by people? How are the stunts being handled? Is it going to be authentic and all this kind of stuff? And I just remember seeing some behind the scenes photos at that point and being like, holy crap, this is going to be the greatest movie ever. And then I saw it and I was like, this is actually the greatest movie I've ever seen. It's amazing. It's funny. It is action-packed. The fight scenes are amazing. Mm-hmm. There's some great special effects scenes in there. But really what I love about it is it's just that it's that perfect mix of like comical and action-packed that was just like – it just all came together there.
It was like a super cool Elvis movie because I think that the Jack Burton character is very Elvis-y.
Yeah.
Other than him not like breaking out into song.
Yeah.
I thought it was very much like that. And it definitely is something that on a quiet rainy night or when I'm not feeling well, I'll pop it back in and watch
it. And the cool thing about Jack Burton is that he's not cool.
Yeah.
He is not a great fighter.
And he's a loser. He's losing everything.
He has very little awareness of what's happening around him. But he has the confidence of the greatest warrior of all of them. So that's one of the great things about the movie is he is constantly surrounded by people who are mentally and physically superior to him in every single way and can do these amazing things. And in his mind, he's kind of the leader of them. And that's what I love about that.
He's not even a good gambler.
That swagger. No, he's not a good gambler. Although he starts off with him winning.
Yeah.
But then in reality, he loses because he gets sucked into this whole thing. But man, that first scene in the airport where the dude busts out the baton.
Yeah.
And he's like, where'd you get that thing? Like that right there. And the look of it, the way that the movie is filmed, oh, it's just so good. So anyways, I didn't mean to go down the road of being a Saturday matinee here, but I could talk about that movie forever. The fact that Boom just put out a book about the making of it to me is just so amazingly super cool. So we had that going on this week. We also found out this week, if I can find the date, that there is a premiere date for Twin Peaks. Where is it? After a year and a half of teasing Matthew and walking off the project and then coming back and then releasing videos of himself eating donuts in the Gordon Cole attire, David Lynch and co-creator Mark Frost will be unveiling his massive Twin Peaks reunion this May on Showtime. Announced today at the TCA press tour, the premium network will air the two-hour premiere of the long-thought-impossible third season of Twin Peaks on May 21st at 9 p.m. Additionally, according to The Nerdist, the third and fourth episodes will be available on Showtime streaming and on-demand platforms that same night.
Wow.
So the first four episodes we get on the first night. The entire season order will consist of 18 episodes, and per network CEO David Nevins, there are currently no plans for another season to follow, but between 18 new episodes of what Nevins refers to as pure heroin version of David Lynch and a cast of 217.
Wow.
217. That might be all we need. I cannot freaking wait for the new season of Twin Peaks. In fact, I have committed to watching all of the other episodes, all 30 episodes of Twin Peaks, which we talked about on this very podcast a couple years ago, again, before May, because I cannot wait for that show.
Very quirky show. If you like things that are – and it was way ahead of its time.
Way
ahead. Because there are so many shows like that now that are getting critical acclaim, viewers all over the place. This was a show that had a very niche audience. And if you watched it, if you're one of the few that watched it, you seem to be a little smarter than the average bear. It was very
it's a show about loving coffee.
Edge. Yeah.
Number one.
Yeah.
It's a show about logs.
Yep.
And the women who talk to them. Although the log lady sadly has passed away, she will not be in it.
Yes.
But so much of the original cast is coming back and so many cool new additions to that cast that if you haven't been following it and you haven't been reading about it, I do not want to spoil it, but I will tell you there are some fantastic additions to that cast. So I cannot wait for that show. That is definitely a show we'll be talking about here.
Mm-hmm. So speaking of shows, we got some comic book shows coming up.
It's a great segue, Matthew.
Yes, it was. On Sunday, February 19th in the Finger Lakes area in upstate New York, we have the Finger Lakes Comic Con. My good friend Rusty Gilligan is going to be there. On March 4th and 5th, we have the Northeast Comic Con, which is happening. I don't exactly have the place, but if you go to necomiccon.com, it changed venues. So it is in a different place. I forgot to write down exactly where it's going. Alex Simmons is going to be there. Joe St. Pierre, Mick Foley, Adam West and Burt Ward are going to be part of it as well. And I may be there. I'm still kind of working that one out. Super Mega Fest, April 7th and the 9th in Marlborough, Massachusetts. You have Christy McNichol, who just got added.
Nice.
My favorite little darling. My favorite. You also have Jim Shooter, who's going to be there, and a whole lot of other cool people. Hudson Valley Comic Con is going to be on May 6th and the 7th. That is in Poughkeepsie, New York. The Plastic City Comic Con, July 29th in Fitchburg, Mass.
At the Wallace Civic Center.
Very excited about that one. I just talked to Keith about an hour ago. And Terrificon, which is happening August 18th, 19th, and 20th at Mohegan Sun, the guest list. I know that a lot of the guest list is up already. Mitch sent me a list of everybody who is going to be there, and it is going to be crazy good.
I will also add, since you mentioned Mitch, that the Connecticut Gamer Con is going to be happening the 1st and 2nd, also at Mohegan Sun, and that is going to be a weekend filled with arcade games, console games, tabletop role-playing games, tournaments, live streams, and hopefully some very, very other cool stuff. Mitch and I were talking earlier this week about some really cool news that could potentially be happening for Connecticut Gamer Con. But I'm excited about this because it is catering to gamers of all types,
yep,
and there is going to be something there for everyone. So there'll be console games, there'll be arcade games, there'll be like D&D tournaments and games being run all weekend, fighting game tournaments, that kind of stuff. So I am super excited about that, and more news is to come about that. But we will keep talking about it because it's only a few months away now.
Yeah, very good.
So there you go. So a quick plug to our friends at VikingOilsLLC.com. That is their website that you can go to get wonderful beard products. My Blood Moon beard oil is almost tapped out now because I have been using it regularly, especially with the weather fluctuations that we mm-hmm. have, where it is pouring rain out and in the 50s right now, and then tomorrow will probably drop below 2 degrees. So that wreaks havoc on a luscious beard like mine, Matthew.
Yep, we've had a couple really cold days that I will say that, although I don't have anything on here but a little bit of stubble, it was so cold I threw on some of the beard balm just on the sides of my face, just in the beard area.
Yeah.
Because it was so – even the walk from my house mm-hmm. to the car to work was awful.
Yep.
So it made me feel a lot better. VikingOilsLLC.com is where you want to go. Check out the information, gift packs, combs, all sorts of crazy things there.
So now let's jump right into comics, Matthew, because we are in a bit of a time constraint this week with basketball schedules and work schedules and illnesses and all kinds of stuff here. You're over there sniffing comics.
Yep.
Let's talk about Gotham Academy number 4. Now, when Gotham Academy started its second semester, I was not blown away by the first issue because it felt like one of the sort of fill-in issues, which is weird because I just I want to know the story behind this book because this book came out like gangbusters.
Yeah.
Gotham Academy to me was like the freshest thing that DC has put out in a while. It had a great cast of characters. It built on the old sort of lore of Gotham and Batman's world and had this awesome gothic-y academy with all of these great new characters. And it was awesome out of the gate. And then when we got up towards the latter issues of the first semester, we got a bunch of like anthology stories that were called, that were under this sort of yearbook storyline. And it almost felt to me like that was filler, either stories that they had written before and were sort of being put in, or they were kind of a little bit behind. So they were putting that stuff in. So it kind of messed up the flow, I think, of what was a really super well put together book. And so we're finally into second semester now, but now with the fourth issue, we have another story that takes place. It says these events take place before second semester. So again, after a couple of issues where we're back in the new semester, we go back again mm-hmm. and we're kind of jumping back and forth. So I'm not loving the discontinuity of what's happening here with this book. However, the reason I wanted to talk about this book today is because I actually think that it is a cool story as a jumping on point. If you have heard me rave about Gotham Academy, if you've heard other people talk about it and you haven't checked it out yet, because this book is really in one story what I love most about Gotham Academy. And so we start off here and you have the headmaster there who is sitting in his office and he's sort of writing in one of his journals and he hears someone outside saying the Carnival Midnight is 100 delights. And he kind of looks up and he looks out the window and the guy keeps saying the Carnival Midnight, 100 delights. And he's looking down and this headmaster is like well into his 80s now. And he looks outside and you see there is this Something Wicked This Way Comes sort of carnival that is rolling into town right by Gotham Academy. And so you've got this guy, you've got the carnival barker in a top hat, you've got an acrobat who's wearing sort of a skeleton mask, you've got a fire breather, you've got sort of a jester that looks kind of creepy and wicked, and then you've got this horse-drawn carriage being driven by a clown who is also very creepy. So next thing you know, we're in the halls of the academy, and you have Olive and Pommeline and Maps who are talking. And there's a kid handing out flyers for the carnival in there. And he's kind of dressed in almost like old-timey garb. And he is saying, oh, Carnival Midnight, take a flyer, take a flyer. And Olive sees him and she's kind of smitten with him. And so he comes over and he hands her a flyer And she doesn't even know what to say. But Maps comes in and says, oh, I'll take three of them. That's great. So they take the flyer to this carnival and they're kind of talking about what it's all about. And of course, Maps, who is kind of the youngest one of their group and the most adventurous one, wants to go visit this carnival. So the next thing you know, they get their sort of Scooby gang together because they're like the Gotham Academy Mystery Club. So you've got Olive, you've got Kyle, you have Colton, I believe his name is, and Pommeline and Maps there. And they go and they visit this carnival. And they're kind of the first ones that come there. And the carnival barker's outside and he's saying, entry is free, my children. All we ask is that you leave your troubles behind and experience the beauty of the night. And as soon as they're about to walk in, the headmaster, who is Collingwood Von Hammer, that's the headmaster's name, the headmaster yells out, the only thing these children are going to experience tonight is the inside of their dorm rooms. And the carnival barker is like, oh, it's good to see you again here. And he says, look, pick up your stuff, pick up your unholy circus, Brother Bet, and drive it from my campus immediately, or I shall be forced to do it for you. And he gets all the kids out of there before they go into the circus and sends them back to their dorm. But he never really explains to them what's going on. So, of course, you have the kids who are now in the library and they're looking up through the records any sort of sign of this particular carnival. Has it ever come through here? Because the school keeps meticulous records of what has happened over the years there. And so they're looking for signs. They find an old folder that is supposed to contain flyers for the circus, but it's empty. And as they're going through stuff, you have this kid who was handing out the flyers before who shows up. And Olive, again, is kind of smitten with him and he's talking to her. And I can't remember if he says his name. But as the other kids are looking through newspaper articles and everything else, what they see is they see a mention of the Carnival Midnight. And you see a picture of what looks like the headmaster, who was a teenager at the time. And the kid who's standing next to him almost looks like the kid who's been handing out the flyers at the school for the carnival. And so they're like, oh, okay, well, that's kind of interesting there. And the kid says, well, you guys get to come to the carnival tonight because we've set up in a different location and, you know, you guys can be the first ones to see it. And so Olive, who's kind of smitten with them, decides, his name is Bernard. She says, okay, we'll go. So, of course, the rest of the crew has to follow her and they decide to go to this carnival. And when they get there, they're the only ones there and they actually go inside this time. And, of course, it's a carnival of horrors. So they go into the lair of the snake lady and there's actually a snake lady in there who is going to try and devour a couple of them. Olive ends up going into the House of Mirrors, and when she gets in there, the carnival barker is there, and he is showing her in the mirrors her past, her future, and what she wants her life to be, which she wants to be reunited with her mother, and her mother's kind of showing up in the mirror. And so as she's looking at that stuff, she is starting to realize that they're trying to lure them in, that this is all some kind of a trick. So you have half the gang who is fighting against the snake lady. You have Olive, who is realizing that she is being duped, and she starts to smash all the mirrors in the place. And then you have her fire powers, which we really haven't seen too much of yet, but Olive has she's like a fire starter. And so when she gets really upset or she gets really mad, she causes fires to happen and she causes the thing to start to burn down. So she ends up going to save her friends and the whole carnival kind of goes up in flames. But before it does, you have the carnival barker confront them and he rips off his face and he's like a huge winged gargoyle underneath it. And so they end up battling him. And as he's about to take the kids out, you have the headmaster who shows up and ends up stabbing this demon, he calls it, and sort of sends it back to the underworld. And so he ends up saving the kids, but the one person who's left from the carnival is this kid, Bernard, who had been handing out the flyers and talking to Olive and everything. And we see that Bernard is, in fact, the headmaster's best friend who got sucked into the carnival almost 80 years ago. Mm. And has been with them ever since. And as soon as the carnival is burnt to the ground, this kid starts to age immediately to the point where he ages and then turns to dust in the arms of his best friend. And so it's this very touching and kind of sad moment, but you have these two friends who get reunited at the end of it, and it's sort of bittersweet. But that, to me, and I should have mentioned this earlier, it is written by Brendan Fletcher. John Lamb is the artist. Steve Wands does the letters. And you have, it says Mark Doyle is, Rebecca Taylor is the editor of this one. This is the kind of story that I love from Gotham Academy. It's a little bit Scooby-Doo, a little bit Harry Potter, a little bit Buffy the Vampire Slayer, and it uses the backdrop of Gotham to build these stories. And I just absolutely love that. So if you haven't checked out Gotham Academy yet, issue number 4 has a one-and-done story that I think really shows you the best of what this book is about, because it touches on all of the different characters. And so it's totally worth picking up. And $2.99.
Very good. Sounds really good. That's those stories that kind of end with the little bit of a heart, a little bit of a you know, that emotional twist. Like when you're starting to talk about it, I'm like, oh, this is going to be a tough one.
Well, what it made me think of is that I was saying how I didn't like the anthology stories, or I didn't like them as much as the overarching storyline that was coming through the first sort of season of this book. But those type of stories do often give people a jumping on point who haven't been following the book. And so they're not all bad if they're a good story in and of themselves. And this is the best one of those that they've done. So it's definitely worth picking up. So if you want to jump on Gotham Academy, issue number 4 is the place to do it.
So one of the best smelling books I've gotten in an awful long time is Supergirl Being Super. This is a 4-issue, they used to call them prestige format books. This is a kind of a little bit of a hardcovery, but not hardcover. It's very cardstock, very glossy. The pages are very glossy. It's a 4-issue story arc that is kind of delving into the life of Supergirl. It looks like with this issue, before she really became Supergirl, before she kind of figured out who she was. This was a book that I was very excited about after I read the first couple issues of the current Supergirl. I was not a fan of it. I didn't like it. There wasn't enough for me to really grab me to make me want to read it every month, especially the fact that the show was so good. I really wanted that comic that would maybe bridge the gaps a little bit. Something that after you read the show and it made you want to go buy a comic book, this would be the one that you could pick up. And I will say that it definitely touches on that. It's written by Mariko Tamakachi and pencils by Joelle Jones, inks by Sandow Floria, colors by Kelly Fitzpatrick, and a beautiful cover by Kelly and Joelle. I'll show you this one. It is, the cover is very dizzying.
Oh, Joelle Jones, who I believe did Madame Frankenstein, was awesome.
That's right.
Yeah,
that's right.
Just awesome.
The cover is very dizzying because it is Supergirl flying upside down. Like you flip the cover over and it's right side up and she's upside down.
Right.
So it is a very dizzying cover, and it just kind of, with Supergirl, you know, this beautiful young girl that has this look on her face like, I don't know what's going on. And that's exactly what happens in this book. So it's a little bit of a narrative of her saying, where do I begin? She's talking about how her pod crashed, a family picked her up, and you see all that really quickly. And then you turn the page and it is school day pictures. So her friends, and you see her core of friends that are all arguing about, why are they doing this yearbook thing now? Why don't they do it at the end of the year? And they're saying, well, you know what? The reason that we're doing it is because most of the kids that are here today will not be here at the end of the year. So you want to make sure. You meet her friend Dolly, who's a lesbian, and she's very open and honest about it, which is very refreshing in this story, because it isn't like when we were seeing about Alex, you saw the frustrations and kind of that part of it. And here you meet this girl, Dolly, who is just enjoying her life. She is loving things, having a great time. And then her other friend, who I'm trying to find her name, Jen is a jock. So Jen's the jock of the group. And you have these three girls, and then you sort of have Kara, who's just trying to figure out where she fits in this world. But the three of them together are, the dynamic is really, really sweet. There's some great moments. And what I loved about it too is that you had three girls that probably shouldn't, maybe back when we were younger, wouldn't have been hanging out together. But here it doesn't matter. You've got three girls that just love each other's companies, are supportive of each other, have a lot of fun. Jen comes up, starts making fun of Kara because she's got a zit on her face. And she's very frank with what, when you talk to her, because she's, you know, Kara's like, so where were you? And she goes, I was peeing. Well, that's pretty honest and where you want to go. So you have Dolly, who, when Dolly went in to get her picture, she's going in there, she's got a hat on. And, you know, they're like, you need to take the hat off right now. When she takes her hat off, she's got this awesome, spiky, shaved sides, purple hair. So, you know what? Perfect. You're doing exactly what you want to do. And then Kara does her picture. Then the next day you see that they're – or the, later that day, you see that they're at track practice. So the three of them are on track together, and they're going through – they got these Fitbit watches that they're going to put on and, you know, check their time, check their temperatures, check everything that, that's going on. And the thing is where you have I've got to go back and find the name, but you have Dolly who is trying to diet. She's really struggling with a lot of things going on with that, and they end up at this diner. And she's like, you know, I can't believe this. You know, I've got to eat a salad and I really just want to gorge myself. And she's looking at Jen saying, you know, it's not fair that you can eat whatever you want. So you see that they have the banter going back and forth. They're talking about how those watches are pretty cool, but they're also becoming a little obsessive because they start looking at, you know, boy, maybe we ought to run quicker. Maybe we ought to burn more calories, all that sort of stuff. And as dinner goes on, they're kind of finishing up with, hey, so don't forget, Kara, you got a birthday tomorrow. That's really cool. Very excited about it. We'll see you guys tomorrow. And then Kara goes home and she lives in a very kind of busy little house outside. Like you see the kitchen and it's a place that I would struggle living in. I saw it. I'm like, it's cluttery. There's clutter everywhere. Her father looks like he tinkers and builds things. It's a farmhouse, but there is like pots and pans hanging from the ceiling. There's stuff just everywhere. She goes out and she sees her pod that she came in. And as she's kind of struggling with her birthday and she's going to be 16, she's kind of trying to figure out where her lot is in life. And that really seems to be where the whole thing goes. Later that night, she flies around. She's up flying around and having a good old time as Dolly's sending her a message and she comes in. Her mother starts talking about, you know, hey, how's everything going? Is everything okay? Did I just hear you get in from the barn? And I don't know if her mother actually knows or her father knows that they're, that she's out there flying around. But she goes to sleep. She's in the middle of a dream where she gets so angry at that zit, she squeezes it. But at later on, when she squeezes it, I will show you, Brian, because she wakes up and there is like stuff everywhere. It is not just like a little bit of a, without putting it too grossly, a little pus splatter on your mirror. She squirts and it is everywhere. And she's thinking it was a dream. I thought it was a dream until the next day she's in school and she is exhausted because she had to clean the entire bathroom up of this mess that she made. So now she's starting to wonder and worry, what was that that I just did? What is going on? Everybody starts asking her because they have a big track meet the next day, how everything's going, what's going on. She goes home. She has her birthday party. She's still wondering about this whole thing that just happened. What's going on? She's remembering about when she first got to use her powers and her father made a comment to her that says, you got to keep that run in your heart and not in your feet because people around here aren't going to understand. And I thought that was a very Pa Kent moment for her. I thought that was very poetic with what she said. So they have their birthday party and then later on the next day, they're ready for the track meet. And as they're getting ready to go, an earthquake happens right before the race. And all of a sudden you look down and Dolly falls into this huge hole. Kara goes in there and saves her, pulls her out of it. And Dolly's kind of figuring out like, how did that just happen? What did you just do? But before anything else can happen, Jen ends up disappearing. And that's where it ends with, did she fall in a hole or not? So you've got the story of Supergirl. You've got a lot of these great moments that happen when you're a kid. You've got a great cast. I think Jen and Dolly are perfect for her. And as I'm reading that and finishing it up, I'm like, I hope one of them doesn't die, which it looks like Jen may have well have died. So the price on it, it is $5.99. I don't want to say it was worth it, but...
But it's like cardstock cover, yep. Double-sized type of deal,
very
right?
Glossy pages. Yeah. You're getting a lot for your money. And like you said, Joel's art is gorgeous.
Right. That is a reason to pick that book up.
Yep.
All right. I'm going to jump back over to the Marvel Universe and talk about a series that I had absolutely no intention of getting myself into. And it was not a huge week for me in terms of books that I was getting. So I looked over at the shelves, Matthew.
I saw it there.
And I saw Inhumans versus X-Men number 0. And I thought to myself, self, if this is going to be sort of the resurgence of the X-Men and the back shelving of the Inhumans, although I don't know how that's going to be because they're coming out with a TV show, but what if this is the X-Men sort of becoming the prominent team back in the Marvel Universe, I at least need to check out the 0 issue. And also because there's been a lot of stuff going on in both the X-Men and Inhuman universes that I haven't followed at all. Hmm. So I also thought, like, how accessible is this going to be? And I also saw that it was written by Charles Soule, and the art was by Kenneth Rocafort, who I'm used to seeing on DC books.
Yeah, he did
he either did Red Hood and the Outlaws, or he did – yeah, so it was something like that. So now he's working on this book with Charles Soule. You have colors by Dan Brown, letters by Clayton Coles, and the editor is Will Moss, Daniel Ketchum, and Nick Lowe is the executive editor there. So this is the issue that's supposed to set you up for Inhumans versus X-Men. And I think overall – it did a good job of that. So I'm going to just read you the beginning. It says, when the Terrigen Mist, the catalyst that grants Inhumans their powers, were discovered to be poisonous to mutants, veteran X-Men Cyclops and Emma Frost set out to destroy the Terrigen clouds that were circling the Earth. Now, you probably remember, Matthew, that over the past couple of years, the Terrigen clouds blow through a town, and then people who are sort of latent Inhumans go into the cocoon, yes, and they get their powers, right? So the X-Men decided they had to destroy those clouds. Though they succeeded in eradicating one cloud and thus half of the Terrigen on Earth, their crusade was cut short when Black Bolt, the king of the Inhumans, retaliated and seemingly killed Cyclops. Okay, you with me so far?
Mm-hmm.
With such great losses on both sides, X-Men and Inhuman leaders agreed to a truce, allowing mutant scientist Dr. Henry McCoy, a.k.a. Beast, to search for a means of peacefully preserving the future of both people. But little did anyone suspect that Emma Frost was keeping a secret. The Cyclops who died in battle with Black Bolt was actually just her psychic projection. The real Cyclops had died earlier of the Terrigen poisoning, but only after telling Emma that mutant kind could not end this way, and thus she has decided to march on until the job is done. So you've got Emma Frost, who wants to get rid of all the Terrigen in the world, and then you have the Inhumans, who want to preserve it because it is the only way that Inhumans who have that latent ability are going to get their powers. And so they don't want to see it go away because then there'll be no more Inhumans. So that's kind of the chessboard as it's set up. In this one, you've got the uncanny Inhumans who are Medusa, Black Bolt, and Iso. You have the all-new Inhumans who are Crystal, Gorgon, Flint, and Grid. Now, of course, none of those names mean anything because the Crystal and Gorgon have been Inhumans since the dawn of time.
Yes.
So they're certainly not all-new Inhumans. Over on the X-Men side, you have Emma Frost, and then you have Phoebe, Mindy, and Celeste, who are the Stepford Cuckoos,
yep,
who I don't know. I don't even know what or who they are.
There were a bunch of them, I think, before. So are these the only two that are left?
There's three.
Okay.
I have no idea. Like, are they – what is their connection to Emma Frost?
She was – I believe from what I can remember, when she was kind of creating her own academy,
uh-huh,
these were three of her protege.
Okay.
So they kind of have that snotty attitude
I've never understood, like, who they are. And I'm sure our X-Men fans will correct us for all the stuff that I don't know. Extraordinary X-Men, you have Storm and Magic. Uncanny X-Men, you have Magneto, Sabretooth, Psylocke, and Monet. And the all-new, all-different X-Men, which are the young sort of kids out of time. Young Beast, Young Iceman, Young Cyclops. So that's your chessboard there. 8 months ago, you have Dr. Henry McCoy and Zhaoyi Chen, who is Iso, the Inhuman. The two of them have been put together to figure out how to either develop a cure for the X-Men so that the Terrigen Mist won't kill them, or figure out some other plan to preserve the Mist in a way that's not going to hurt the X-Men. Then you have on Muir Island, you have Emma Frost, who's at the grave of Scott Summers, and she is going up to visit the grave, which is on like the top of this cliff, and then throwing herself off the cliff, and right before she hits the ground, turns to diamond. And she's like timing herself every time. And you have the Stepford Cuckoos who show up and they're like, why do you keep doing that? And she says, well, I need to quicken the time that it takes me to turn into diamond. So if I throw myself off the side of a cliff, then that kind of puts a lot of pressure on me to figure out how to do that really quickly. And each time I wait until I'm closer to the ground before I do it. And they're like, why would you do that? And she basically tells them, well, the next time I have to go up against Black Bolt, I'm going to need that ability. And so she's already preparing for a confrontation with the Inhumans at this point. So she's kind of going down the path of, this is going to end with us fighting. Meanwhile, you've got Beast, who is with Iso, and Iso is kind of saying, you know, aren't you nervous? This is like, if we don't succeed, we're kind of screwed and there's going to be a fight, or, you know, something bad's going to happen. One of our sides is either not going to exist anymore or whatever. And Hank is basically saying to her, no, I'm not worried about it, because anything is possible with science. and he pulls out his cell phone and takes a picture. He's like, the fact that we can take a picture here, take a selfie, and you think about that now, if this was something that happened thousands of years ago, if you showed this to a caveman, they would have thought that you were a god. So this is stuff that science has put together. We can figure this out. And so he's pretty optimistic about that. But as this book goes on, what you're seeing is you're seeing Hank and Iso go to visit the Inhumans, because in the South Pacific, there is Crystal and her group are following the Terrigen clouds around the world. And whenever it's about to enter an area, they scan it for X-Men or mutants. Mm-hmm. And then they go and rescue those humans and take the mutants and take them out of there before they get infected by the Terrigen mist. So they're trying to do their part to help mutants not be affected by the Terrigen mist. And so this Zero issue is kind of a world tour of everybody kind of going around talking about the different measures that they're taking to try and avoid an ultimate confrontation between the Inhumans and the X-Men. And you see as the book goes on that Hank is getting less and less optimistic about what's happening. First thing he notices is that the Terrigen cloud is shrinking. And he's wondering what the reason could be for that. So they end up going to the Savage Land, and he's putting these sensors out on the Savage Land to see whether or not the Terrigen mists are actually like absorbing into the soil and stuff like that, because that would not be good for the X-Men, obviously. Then you have Emma, who's going and visiting Magneto, and she's basically having this cryptic conversation with Magneto where she's kind of saying, look, I'm going to have to do what needs to be done with this whole Inhuman thing, and so I need to know that you're going to back me. And so she's getting support from him. Then you have, after that, you have the young X-Men show up, and they're having a conversation about what is going to happen in the future. And Emma shows up to them and says, look, I might need your support with something in the near future. So I just need to know you guys are with me. And then you have 2 months left in this agreement that they have. And you have Beast go and visit Medusa. And he's kind of explaining to her that he has not figured out a solution yet as to how they're going to stop this from happening. And he overhears a conversation with Medusa where she's saying to the other Inhumans, Beast hasn't found a solution. I will continue to support him in every way I can. He's a good man, a brilliant man, and honest. But a day will come when the mutants lose their patience with him and with us and with this truce. Another attack will come. We will not start the fight, but we must be ready to win it. And so she's kind of preparing for things to happen. And then you see that Emma is having a meeting at the Hellfire Club, and you don't really see who she's meeting with, but she's now having a meeting with someone else there. And then the book ends basically with the sort of beginning of things starting to fall apart. And so overall, I thought that it did a really good job of sort of giving you what the stakes were. I still don't know a lot of what is happening in the actual worlds of the X-Men and the Inhumans. So a lot of like the interpersonal stuff that you would have to have been reading those books to know, I don't know that stuff. Obviously, I did not see the death of Cyclops, and I did not see the whole psychic projection thing from Emma. But I think if you're just looking to figure out like, why are the Inhumans and X-Men about to fight, and why does it matter? Like in Civil War, I thought they did a terrible job of setting up stakes that you cared about.
Mm-hmm.
You had a kid who could see in the future, and they're fighting about what the best way to handle that is, and that becomes Civil War II. Stupid. In the Inhumans versus the X-Men, you have the mutants who are literally dying because the Terrigen Cloud is poisonous to them. They want to get rid of the Terrigen. You have the Inhumans who are saying, then none of us will ever be born again because we need that Terrigen mist in order to activate our powers. Mm-hmm. So there's actual like future of the, you know, future of mutant kind, future of inhuman kind at stake. Those are big stakes.
Yeah.
So to me, that feels a little bit more like, okay. And I like the way that you have like a Medusa saying, look, I'm going to do everything I can to work with this guy, but this may not end the way that we want it to. And you have Emma who's kind of moving around behind the scenes and getting ready for the confrontation. That to me seems a little more well thought out. And again, I mentioned before, Charles Soule, right?
Yep.
So Charles Soule, and I believe Jeff Lemire is writing mm-hmm. the main series with him. So with those two guys, I feel like they do a pretty good job. I mean, those are two guys who were on Swamp Thing. And didn't Soule do one of those? Because I know Lemire did Animal Man.
He did Swamp Thing. Soule did.
And Soule did Swamp Thing. So and that was during the whole storyline of the red versus the green and all that kind of stuff. So the big picture stuff, I feel like those guys have a pretty good approach to. And this was interesting enough that I think I want to read more of it. And so, but I'm going to let you judge for yourself because I actually have a code here, Matthew. So if you go to marvel.com/redeem, because this is a $5 book, and you want to find out what the heck is going on with the Inhumans and the X-Men, you can enter the following code first. FZMX9GP720EH. If you enter that code first at marvel.com/redeem, you will get yourself a copy of Inhumans versus X-Men, and you can judge for yourself.
Very good. And speaking of Charles Soule, we are going to be talking about the last issue in the current arc at Daredevil, number 14. It is called Dark Art. Now, this is not a whimsical Daredevil. Like, we raved and loved the Mark Waid run on Daredevil. To me and to you especially, that was the definitive Daredevil run. I agreed with that. I loved it. I loved the feel, the style, everything about it. And Dark Art, Ron Garney's doing the art on this one. Matt Milla is the colorist. Clayton Cowles does the letters. And Ron and Matt do the cover on this one. It is definitely a darker, more street level than the other series.
Which is not a bad thing.
It isn't. This definitely ties more into the TV series. So if you're watching the TV series, you're going to really get a lot out of this one. So what has been going on here is that you have a guy named Muse who has created art by using human bodies.
Oh.
And if you remember a bunch of years ago, wasn't there an exhibit? And I think the exhibit still may go around where they were using actual cadavers. And it was like the body something, but they were using actual cadavers.
I'm sure there was.
And it was even in Casino Royale. That was a little bit of it as well. There was a scene in Florida with that. But it was sort of an exhibit where you would have actual human bodies cut open on display so you could see the muscles. They would be in poses and things like that. So this guy was doing it as well. Started an art gallery. People were freaking out over it, as they did with this exhibit that I'm talking about in the real world. Now, Daredevil was realizing that some of these art, these bodies in this exhibit, pieces of bodies, belong to missing people.
Oh.
And all of a sudden, a detective, and I can't think of his name, I'm trying to find it, but there is a detective that works for the Inhumans who is now helping Daredevil. He's a former NYPD. He is now working with the Inhumans. So he's sort of their head of security, head of police force, working with Daredevil because he has ways to help Daredevil because the Inhuman population is being affected by this as well.
Okay.
So he is there helping Daredevil. And we are in the last issue. He's got a friend, Blindspot, who's been helping him out. And Muse has now taken Blindspot. So he doesn't know where he is. Daredevil gets down on the ground, and I think his name is Jim, but he walks up.
I mean,
and
to be fair, with a name like Blindspot, could they just not be seeing him?
Yes.
I mean.
Because he goes disappearing.
You know what I'm saying?
So he's trying to find him, and he says, you know what, I'm going to look. So he gets down on the floor, like right in the middle of Main Street, sits down and just starts meditating. And you're seeing some great styles in art where you see people and cars walking by him. Then he's focusing so much, everything's starting to disappear.
I like that stuff.
You get a couple pages of it, which sometimes I get a little struggly with that because it's almost like wasted pages.
If it's more than one or two pages of it, I don't necessarily like it. But I like when you have like the two-page splash and you're seeing his sort of radar sense emanate out. I like them showing you his ability like that.
So what is really cool is after a couple pages of that, he finds where he is. And you see that Muse is like this all white, wearing black pants and suspenders and a black hat and red eyes. You don't see a mouth. You don't see a nose. And he gets Blindspot. He brings him over and he's talking to him saying, hey, you know what? I'm very excited because you're going to be part of my exhibit. And you should be very happy about that because, you know, it's interesting that people always love and talk about art, but there's a little bit of an agony to it. And when he pulls the mask off of him, you see pieces of bodies everywhere. A head's on a pike. There's blood all over some canvas. There's a torso there. Hanging up from the rafters are hearts, lungs, livers, brains, all sorts of things. And Blindspot,
creating things is not a neat process,
no.
Matthew. You know?
Blindspot is looking up going, yeah, this is not going to end well for me. So as he is listening to this whole thing, he looks up on a canvas and you've got a guy that is pinned to it, chopped up and bleeding and still alive.
Huh.
He's basically telling him, you know, there's things that, you know, you got to suffer for your art. People are suffering for
my
art.
You do.
And all of a sudden, Daredevil comes flying in. They get into a big fight. But before the fight can go on, Daredevil tells him, you know, let Blindspot go. and this will not end as badly as it's going to. And he says, well, you know what? I think I'm feeling a little artistic right now. I feel inspired. And then you turn the page and you see that the muse jams his fingers into Blindspot's eyes and yanks his eyes out. So now Blindspot is actually blind. And then Daredevil, and then he falls down on the floor. Daredevil catches him, and he's like, it's going to be all right. It's going to be all right. And now Daredevil is just livid. So bets are off. Daredevil goes up. And for the next three or four pages, you've got a crazy, awesome fight until they get into a room where Daredevil all of a sudden is trying to sense where he is and realizes it's a two-page spread that there are probably 60 to 100 bodies hanging from the rafters, all bleeding down into buckets. So he kind of freaks out about that. He goes in. He finally catches what's his name? As he goes by, he sees Daredevil sees sort of a winch. He kind of lets the winch go. All the bodies start to come down. Some of them look like they come a little too hard. He starts winding them down to bring all the bodies off the ceiling. And that is where what's-his-name's trying to make his escape, Muse. But as Muse gets up on the roof to hide, he runs into all sorts of inhuman police. He runs into the officer that's been working with him. And he goes up and he says, you know what? Hands where I can see him, you piece of trash. Where is Daredevil? And he goes, oh, he's not far away. And you see Daredevil come up, and he's got Muse has got these handcuffs on him. And he's saying, you know, he just took his eyes. He took Blindspot's eyes. Where's the justice in that? And then Muse kind of cracks his knuckles a little bit, gets his hands out of the handcuffs, and peels the mask back to show like this mummified face where he didn't have eyes either.
Huh.
Kind of a mess. And then the cop tells him, you know, oh, don't worry about it. We're going to take care of him. He's going to get the help he needs, but he's also going to get taken care of. And then he also says, we would like to take Blindspot. And human medicine can do a little bit more than human medicine. Maybe we can fix him and get him right. So he takes him away. And it's really kind of a nice moment because he looks at Blindspot and he says, there were more than 100 people in there. And Blindspot says, did you save them? And he says, yes. And then he says, then it was worth it. And then he gets put in the carrier and taken away. So a great issue, a great end to this this arc. Interesting to see where it's going to go again. I've really enjoyed what is going on, but I'm kind of not enjoying how dark it is. I'd rather have it be a little more out in the open than it was. This was a really long story arc. I'm not big into the 5 or 10 issue ones.
Yep.
But I do understand in this day and age, books are written for trades.
Yep.
So if you are interested in this story, I mean, granted, it is at the end of the arc, but if you go to marvel.com/redeem, VICZOIB65UZ10. It's not an I, it's a 10.
There you go.
So there you go. You can get
two Cracker Jack prizes in this episode of Secret Identity. So that's pretty good.
Since Cracker Jack doesn't give you prizes anymore.
Yeah, that's right. We still do.
And we will pull your fillings out as well.
That's exactly right. Except not in the fun way, like when you're eating Cracker Jacks.
Yeah.
Just like
a pair
of pliers or something.
There
like
we
that.
Go.
So, all right. Well, that ended up more dark than we wanted to. The bottom line is we wanted to give you something on this show. That is going to wrap up this particular episode of the Secret Identity Podcast. So for Mr. Matthew A. Herring, this is Brian Letendry signing off. Have a great rest of your week, and we will talk to you in a few short days.
Bye-bye.
The rest of the comic publishing world may finally be arriving to the party, but Drive-Thru Comics is the one that started it all. The first downloadable comic shop is still leading the way when it comes to digital comics. Featuring hundreds of publishers, excellent prices, and top-notch customer service, Drive-Thru is a great experience all around. Another thing that sets Drive-Thru apart from a lot of other digital comics platforms is this. When you buy a comic, you own it. You get a watermarked PDF file that you can read on your laptop, your tablet, phone, or any other device. You choose how you enjoy the comics you buy. So head over to drivethroughcomics.com today, and on your way to checking out, download a free issue of Secret Identity.